Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today, you find us in the depths of rural Norway, sometime in the mid-20th century. It's very cold and dark enough for stars to appear, and a hard frost covers the ground. A young girl strides purposefully down the road, wrapped in a thick coat, her forehead all that is left exposed, her eyes fixed on the road ahead. A long drawn-out crack echoes like a gunshot. It is the ice moving in the lake below. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund books they really want to read.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of Year of Reading Dangerously, and today we're joined by two guests, one returning and one making their debut. Welcome back, Max Porter, and welcome, Carl Ove Nausgaard. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Carl Ove is a Norwegian writer whose work, including the six-volume sequence My Struggle, the novel A Time for Everything, The Seasons Quartet, and most recently in English, The Morning Star, has been published in 35 languages. He has published 22 books spanning fiction, non-fiction, essays, and biographical portraits of Edvard Munch and Anselm Kiefer. Early next year, there will be a publication of the paperback of Carl Ove's collection of essays in the land of the Cyclops. He is joined by Max Porter, who was last with us back in August 2019. Goodness me, that feels like a long time ago. To talk about Ridley Walker in our live recording at the Paul Elliott's Festival. Incidentally, if listeners, you've never heard that particular episode, it is genuinely one of our favourites, partly because of the readings by Max and by Una McCormack from the remarkable novel Ridley Walker in front of a live audience, totally captivated by what they heard. A really magical, magical moment. Oh, I felt it was anyway. Max, did you feel that? Felt really special, that one.
Yeah, I have really warm memories of that time, partly because of it was at Port Elliot, wasn't it? And that's a thing of the past.
Can no longer be again.
So, yes. I loved it. We finished our chat about Ridley Walker and I went and got a pint of beer and jumped in the estuary.
That's how we try and finish every episode of Backlist. It can be hard.
But also I kept on thinking about that book.
Yes.
I know we all do. We have all kept on thinking about that book ever since any of us first read it. But it's a nice kind of staging post in my lifelong thinking about that book.
I think we could record another episode on that book, no problem at all, and say an hour's worth of totally different things as well.
Different things.
Do you know what I mean? So rich. And before that, Max, you joined us for episode 32, where we talked about The Many Virtues of the Horse's Mouth by the Irish writer Joyce Carey. Max is the author of three novels, and his fourth, Shy, will be published by Faber and Faber and Grey Wolf Press in spring 2023. His work has been translated into 30 languages.
But the book we're here to discuss is a 20th century classic, The Ice Palace, or Is Slottet, by Tarjei Vesaas, one of Norway's greatest modern writers. First published by Gyldendal in 1963, it went on to win the Nordic Council Literary Prize in 1964. In 1966, it was published in Elizabeth Rokkan's English translation by Peter Owen, who described it as the best novel he ever published. Max Porter agrees. He's surprised it isn't the most famous book in the world. But we'll also be discussing The Birds, or Fuglarna, by Vesaas, published 6 years earlier, and which Carl Ove thinks is even better. Anyway, before we start strapping on our skis and bearskins, Andy, what have you been reading this week?
Well, I'm really happy to say that I've been reading the new book by Bob Dylan, which is called The Philosophy of Modern Song. As you know, Bob Dylan is an author who's published several books. He published Tarantula in the early 1970s. That's his novel. And he published Writings and Drawings, which is a collection of his art, his essays, and his lyrics. And he published Chronicles, which is one of the best music books ever written. All right-thinking people would agree with that. And ushered in a wave of music books in its wake. And now he's written this book, The Philosophy of Modern Song, since which time, of course, the publisher Chronicles, he has won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Tarje Vesos was nominated 50 times for the Nobel Prize for Literature, or thereabouts. Bob Dylan was nominated twice, I think I'm right in saying, and won on the second occasion, controversially. I reckon this new book came about because some enterprising editor or agent went to Bob's people and said, you know that radio program you used to do, Theme Time Radio Hour, in which Bob would read links between records that he'd chosen. It was a terrific show. It ran on the internet. I think there are two, maybe three seasons of it. And I think this book probably came about because somebody said to Dylan's people, you know, I reckon there's a book in that if we just got Bob to put down his thoughts about artists or music or people that he likes. And this is the equivalent. What you get is Dylan writing about all manner of records, some of which you might expect, such as Detroit City by Bobby Bear, or Ball of Confusion by The Temptations, obscure stuff like Doesn't Hurt Anymore by John Trudell, Dean Martin's in here, Blue Moon, It's All in the Game, Tommy Edwards. But I'm going to read to you from early in the book, where Bob shares his thoughts about Pump It Up by Elvis Costello and the Attractions. And this made me laugh out loud when I was walking through the city in which I'm currently living last week. Because on the audiobook version of The Philosophy of Modern Song, Dylan has recorded parts of it, seemingly in an echoing corridor outside a dressing room while out on the road somewhere. And then one of a number of celebrity readers takes over from Bob. So you start by listening to Bob giving it the 80-year-old Bob, like that. And then Pump It Up, the celebrity who takes over the audiobook duties from him is Helen Mirren. Which is quite a jarring contrast. But this is also wonderful, this description of Pump It Up. I want you to imagine the first section I read. I'm just going to say Bob Dylan. I won't do the voice. Bob Dylan. And then I'm going to say it goes to Helen Mirren after that, okay? Pump It Up, Elvis Costello, originally released on the album This Year's Model, Radar, 1978, written by Elvis Costello. And now here's what Bob Dylan has to say. This song speaks new speak. It's the song you sing when you've reached the boiling point. Tense and uneasy, comes with a discount, with a lot of giveaway stuff. And you're going to extend that stuff till it ruptures and splits into a million pieces. You never look back, you look forward. You've had a classical education and some on-the-job training. You've learned to look into every loathsome, nauseating face and expect nothing. You live in a world of romance and rubble, and you roam the streets at all hours of the night. You've acquired things and brought people the goods. This song is brainwashed and comes to you with a low-down, dirty look, exaggerates and amplifies itself until you can flesh it out and it suits your mood. This song has a lot of defects, but it knows how to conceal them all. Okay, so that's what Dylan says about it. And now here's what Helen Mirren says about it. Elvis is one of those guys whose fans fall somewhere between the two poles of passion and precision. There are people who tick off the boxes of his life with the same obsession of someone completing a train schedule, while others don't know anything beyond the fact that he sings a song that accompanied a particularly devastating breakup. Very seldom a cheery wedding song, but plenty of breakup songs. Knowing a singer's life story doesn't particularly help your understanding of a song. Frank Sinatra's feelings over Ava Gardner allegedly inform I'm a Fool to Want You, but that's just trivia. It's what a song makes you feel about your own life that's important. Elvis Costello and the Attractions were a better band than any of their contemporaries. Light years better. Elvis himself was a unique figure. Horn-rimmed glasses, quirky, pigeon-toed and intense. The only singer-guitarist in the band. You couldn't say that he didn't remind you of Buddy Holly, the Buddy stereotype, at least on the surface. Elvis had Harold Lloyd in his DNA as well. At the point of Pump It Up, he'd obviously been listening to Springsteen too much. But he also had a heavy dose of Subterranean Homesick Blues. Pump It Up is a quasi-stop-time tune with powerful rhetoric, and with all this, Elvis exuded nothing but high-level belligerence. He was belligerent in every way, even down to the look of his eyes. A typical Englishman or Irishman, didn't matter how much squalor he was living in, always appeared in a suit and tie. Back then, English people appeared in suits and ties no matter how poor they were. With this manner of dress, every Englishman was equal. Unlike in the States, where people wore blue jeans and work boots and any type of attire, projecting conspicuous inequality. The Brits, if nothing else, had dignity and pride, and they didn't dress like bums. Money or no money, the dress code equalised one and all in old Britain. Pump It Up is intense and as well-groomed as can be. With tender hooks and dirty looks, heaven-sent propaganda and slander that you wouldn't understand. Torture her and talk to her, bought for her, temperature was a rhyming scheme long before Biggie Smalls or Jay-Z. Submission and transmission, pressure pin and other sin just rattled through this song. It's relentless, as all his songs from this period are. Trouble is, he exhausted people. Too much in his songs for anybody to actually land on. Too many thoughts, way too wordy. Too many ideas that just bang up against themselves. Here, however, it's all compacted into one long song. Elvis is hard-edged with that belligerence that somehow he is able to streamline into his work. The songs are at top speed, and this is among his very best. In time, Elvis would prove he had a gigantic musical soul, too big for this type of aggressive music to contain. He went all over the place, and it was hard for an audience to get a fix on him. From here on, he went to play chamber music, write songs with Burt Bacharach, do country records, cover records, soul records, ballet and orchestral music. When you are writing songs with Burt Bacharach, you obviously don't give a fuck what people think. Elvis blows through all kinds of genres like they are not even there, and Pump It Up is what gives him a license to do all these things. Who doesn't want to run from this podcast straight to their copy of this year's model and play Pump It Up, true. Right? What it's so this book is so enjoyable, and as you may have noted from from Bob's thoughts on Elvis Costello, Dylan is nothing if not king of the backhanded compliment. So yeah. I really enjoy this book with your eyes or with your ears. It's called The Philosophy of Modern Song. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it costs £35. John, what have you been reading this week?
I've been reading Emergency by Daisy Hildyard. It's her second novel. Her first, Hunters in the Snow, got lots of terrific reviews. And then she wrote a non-fiction book. I keep worrying away, as listeners to this podcast will know, keep worrying away at books about the countryside, the pastoral novel. Ever since I think Salman Rushdie told me that it was a moribund, dead form, I've always felt the need to go out and try and seek out pastoral novels that aren't. I spoke about All Lamb on the last episode, PJ Harvey's remarkable verse novel set in and around a Dorset village. Emergency is set in a Yorkshire village in the 1990s. The woman, the narrator, the unnamed narrator, is looking back on her childhood. And in very similar ways, it's kind of playing around in woods and quarries near her home, observing the difficulties of adult life, while also closely observing the movements of nature. And also, I suppose it's the emergency in the title is all of this lovely pastoral stuff is happening in a world that's slowly choking to death and dying. And pesticides and plastics, the stuff of late 20th century childhood, are part of the problem. Somehow, Daisy Hildyard manages in her episodic way to make a really beautiful and kind of, I wouldn't call it a page turning novel, but I read it very quickly and found it completely captivating. Certainly, if you're a fan of Daisy Johnson's Fen or Fiona Moseley's Elmet or Sarah Hall's short stories or, dare I say it, Max Porter's Lanny, you're going to find this book attractive and rewarding. Anyway, the kestrel is hovering close to the mole. And she looks at the mole. I could see him intimately now. His features were precise and miniature, acorn cup ears, thread-fine whiskers radiating in all directions, and tiny hand-shaped feet. His whole body was vibrating violently. He seemed unable to move. The kestrel had paused again, and my gaze moved up and down, drawing a direct line between them, like a lift between two floors of a building. I felt a sense of love arise inside me, as huge and widespread as the vole was small and specific, and it occurred to me that I could rescue him. I knew what this would mean because I'd done it before. When the huge black rabbit who lived in a run in our garden had a nest full of babies, my parents had told me not to touch them. I sat outside the hutch and waited for them to be revealed when their mother rolled aside tiny pink squirming things which were in the process of becoming, from day to day, delicate versions of their parents. When they were a week or so old, skin still visible through a sheen of black fur, my mother explained why I wasn't to touch them. The rabbit would eat her babies if they had a strange smell on them. I held my hands in front of my face, but they didn't smell like anything except faintly soap. Anyway, she takes, of course, one of the little rabbit pups, and then, of course, she returns it. The following day, I went to see the rabbits, and the mother was alone in her run. She was truly a big rabbit. I watched her for a while. She seemed calm, nibbling dandelion leaves, and I felt a sense of affinity with her because we had done it together, destroyed the babies with our colossal care. Even today, she seems to me very human in the way her principles forced her to self-destruct and in the scale of her appetite, which far exceeded what she needed to survive, those dandelion leaves. I don't mean that the rabbit was much like a person, more that principles and will, amongst most other qualities, memory, love, are not exclusively human traits by any reasonable definition. All creatures have character. Really great little book. It was weird reading that in the same week that I was reading Visas, because there's definite sense of the weird allegorical relationship that we have perhaps with nature, or that nature has with us.
Okay, so what's the name of the book?
That is Emergency by Daisy Hildyard, published by the ever excellent Fitzgeraldo Editions.
Great.
Back to Torje Vesas and the Ice Palace. It was Nikki Birch, our producer, who first alerted us to this short but brilliant novel in our summer reading episode back in 2020. It's the story of Sis and Un, two 11-year-old girls. Sis is popular and outgoing, and Un more reserved, an orphan, and newly arrived at the village school. They are powerfully and mysteriously drawn to each other. Shocked by the intensity of her feeling after Sis visits her at her auntie's house, Un decides she will skip school the next day to visit the waterfall on the river that the other children have mentioned. The weather has been so cold it's frozen the waterfall into a huge and complex pillar of ice, alluring and terrifying in equal measure. The fallout from that decision fills the book's final 80 pages. Written in a deceptively simple language, it explores love, guilt, sexual awakening, and our complex relationship with nature in a way that is profoundly original and memorable.
How simple this novel is, wrote Doris Lessing. How subtle, how strong, how unlike any other. It is unique, it is unforgettable, it is extraordinary. And these are all qualities the Ice Palace shared with another novel, The Birds, which was first published in 1957. The story of Mattis, a man in his late 30s who lives with his older sister. Despite or because of his learning difficulties, he enjoys an intense relationship with the natural world and the ability to pose the deepest of philosophical questions. It's another quietly devastating story about loneliness and the difficulty we have making ourselves understood. Karl Ove has called it the best Norwegian novel ever and said it would have been counted among the great classics from the last century if it had been written in one of the major languages. And as we have Karl Ove here to develop that thought, Let me ask you, we would normally ask you, when did you first encounter the work of Tarje Vesas? But in a sense, I suppose what I would like to know is both that and could you just put Vesas into context for English-speaking readers in terms of his importance in terms of modern Norwegian literature?
Yeah, I can't say when I first heard about Vesas or learned about him at all, because he's always there. He's taught at schools and he's kind of one of the most important writers. So he's in the canon. He's everywhere, really. So I just tried to write an essay about the birds for an anthology, and it was almost impossible. Because everyone knows everything, so there's nothing to say about it, really. But then I reread both The Ice Palace and The Birds, and I found that didn't really matter. It was all about presence, all about being in the book. It's all about being there, which especially The Birds 2 is about somehow.
Max, when did you first become aware of either Vesas or The Ice Palace specifically?
I think I might have read The Birds first. I had a crush on the catalogue of Peter Owen. I'd read Silence by Shusaku Endo, which I can recommend the backlisted podcast episode on. With Sarah Perry, which is a great one. And also The Year of the Hare by Arto Pasolino. And both had rather a profound effect on me, as well as some books obviously by Hermann Hesse and Paul Bowles. And I just thought, well, this publisher is perhaps the best publisher of translated literature. You know, I can't imagine that I would have another hit with this publisher. And then I read The Ice Palace, and I think it's certainly one of my very favorite books. But my experience of reading it was an almost spiritual revelation, really. But that was how I came to it. Yeah, my love of Peter Owens. But and then someone who worked at Peter Owen heard that I was enjoying all these books and then came and gave me all the Peter Owen books, which started a kind of great binge of, you know, some of the greatest writers of all time, I think, really.
Peter Owen binge, that's a thing.
Yeah.
That sounds like a thing.
Well, I told John in a message that when I was reading The Birds this week, I opened it up and my copy of The Birds is actually signed by Vesas. To Peter Owen.
To Peter Owen. They gave him away the file copy. Oh no.
Yeah. signed July 68 with greetings for Peter.
Wow.
That is extraordinary.
So I think I should probably give it back to them. It probably belongs in their archive.
Will you though?
You have to know, I guess.
you fool, Max. You fool, you damn fool.
From what I can gather, that the Ice Palace was the first of... I don't know whether Vesas had been published in English any of his previous novels. He wrote 25 novels in all, as I think, Karlova. So he's much more prolific writer than we would... I mean, these are the two that get talked about most in the English language world. But
what
he was,
kind of maniac say, would write that many books, Carl? I don't understand.
Lived a long life.
Before I come back to you, Colover, I'd like to ask Max, you glancingly referred to a spiritual experience there of reading The Ice Palace, right, the first time?
Yeah.
Where is the spiritual element of the novel?
Well, for me, it is in the... In the broader kind of Vesas universe, the relationship between human beings and the natural world, but particularly in this book, the way that is set against a sort of devastatingly insightful portrayal of childhood unease and affection and nameless emotional currents passing between different human beings, almost like a spiritual charge, be it erotic or political or whatever it is. He does that almost better than any writer I have ever come across, to the point where it's as if the book itself has an aura beyond its subject, to do with the sort of potency of its truth. I think particularly about the relationship between the children and the adult, and then the natural world. It gets into your skin in the way closer to the condition of music or visual art. And I think it was one of the first times I'd experienced that as a reader. At that time in my life, I was, as we all are all the time, searching for work that for the truth, for work that kind of goes beyond the what I felt to be the kind of mannerisms of the social realist novel or whatever it was. It kind of cut through what I deemed to be a certain artificiality at work. And because perhaps of what you've said, you've mentioned as the kind of allegorical features of his work, or partly because of the sheer spaced out, the extraordinary aesthetic that he achieves, as well as the kind of brutal honesty of his portrayal of mental processes and social processes, it was revelatory to me, as you know, as Talis was when I first heard it or something. I'm sort of reaching around for comparisons, but there wasn't really any when I first read it. I thought I had found a higher form.
He's the sort of writer that you might apply this to, a filmmaker or a musician or a chef who is clearly operating to a well worked out aesthetic, but you don't know what it is. And part of the appeal as a reader is trying to puzzle it out from the, infer it from the clues contained in the writing. So there's a real steady sense of this, I am telling you this because this is so important to how I see the world and how I create. And I always find that very seductive, actually. I find that makes me want to sink into the work. And I'd never read him before we did for this. And I don't want to, you know, copy you, Max, and say it was spiritual, but it was certainly incredibly stimulating to think, oh, great, I don't know what the rules of this are. That's so appealing to me.
It's very interesting. Also, you mentioned that his worldview and his way of looking at things appears in two girls that are 11 in one book, and in an idiot in another. So it's two places in society where normally nothing of value is going on. You know, it's like it's beyond what's important, and there it happens, which I think is interesting in itself and a big part of his genius, really, to go there.
And also that strikes me also to have something in common with the realm of the spiritual, in as much as the more difficult questions of forgiveness, tolerance, taboo, these are questions that are in the darker corners of the dogma of the church or the moral preachings of religious leaders, and as you say, he just goes straight to them with a kind of unfussiness, with a kind of representational clarity that is so rare that it strikes one as profound. And also there's no trickery, there's no showmanship about it. It's utterly direct. These books strike me as incredibly honestly built. There's no sort of theatrical strategies at work, really, beyond the sort of depth of their investigation. And I find that incredibly impactful as a reader.
Don't you also find it? I think of how many ways that story of a new child at school could be told. Usually you would expect her to be bullied. Every point, it seems to me, he kind of, Andy's, that's a really great way of describing that you're not sure what rules he's adhering to.
That you know there is a set of rules.
Yes,
yeah,
but you...
That's the point.
Yeah, but every point, it seems to me, he undercuts the kind of the lazy narrative expectation of what this is a coming of age novel. This is about a girls in school and kids arguing. That the kids don't actually bully Un. And the way he paints that relationship between the two girls seems to me to be, I mean, you know, it's a book you have to read and reread to get to get the full marrow of meaning, I think.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask Colliver a very difficult question.
Oh no.
Which is, I'm so sorry, but I assume you haven't read the translations that we've read. So we're reading him in English.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the distinguishing traits of his prose are in Norwegian.
It's very simple and very, very melodic and very, I think the comparison to music is very relevant. And there is a thing with Vesaas is that he writes a new Norwegian. Yeah. We don't have to go into that, but it's the same as Jon Fosse, basically. And it's unthinkable. Jon Fosse is unthinkable without Tarjei Vesaas. Fosse's first book is like a continuation of Vesaas somehow. And then he develops in his own. But the simplicity is key.
And the musicality as well. It's funny that the simplicity, I think, is there in the translations.
Yeah.
The musicality, I think, is much harder for a translator to capture. I don't know, John, what you think.
I don't speak Norwegian, but I love the sound of it, and I love the kind of the rhythm of it. We'll probably read a couple of extracts. I don't think you'll get the full effect of that in English, because English is such a mongrel language. But I think the idea of this being, you know, you were saying talus, you know, kind of it's polyphonic music. It's not harmony. You've got two different strains that are running at the same time. The theme of un and then the theme of sis in one, or rather like the sort of the theme of Mattis in the birds and the theme of his sister. They're not harmonies. But they are polyphonic, spatial, three dimensional. They feel like the spaces in them are really important.
Yeah.
Well, listen. Why don't we show, not tell? Max, could you read us a little bit of from one of the English translations, and then I might ask Karlove to give us his reaction to whether he feels it's capturing the sense of the Norwegian original.
Yeah.
I had forgotten, and perhaps I don't know how it is for you, Carl, having not read these for some time and returning to them now, but I had forgotten some of the more audacious stylistic flourishes at work in these books, particularly in The Birds, with what's happening in Mattis's mind and how he formulates that as a sort of almost like a sort of prophetic, radical visionary. You know, he has these sort of visionary, you know, Hildegard of Bingen style blasts occur in his mind, and I had forgotten that in the texture of these books. Anyway, this is the Ice Palace. They had finished their walk. It was black night. Auntie had gone the rounds. They came to Sissy's house first. A single lamp shone waiting for her. There was no sound. Well, here we are. And I'd like to say, began Auntie, but Sis said quickly, no, I'll see you home. Oh, no, don't bother. I'm not afraid of the dark. I'm sure you're not, but may I? Yes, of course you may. They set off once more. The sleeping house with the waiting lamp wheeled away. The road was deserted. They began to feel a little tired. I'm not cold. Not a bit, said Auntie. And Sis ventured to ask, what will you do in the place where you're going to live? She did not know where it was. It had not been mentioned. Auntie was used to seeing to everything on her own. Oh, I shall have to busy myself with something or other. I'll find something, she said. I've sold the house, too, you know. Don't worry about me for an instant, Sis. No. I'm a worthless creature, said Auntie shortly afterwards when they were nearing her house, nearing the end of the evening. She began again, worthless. The people here have done everything for me during this misfortune, and now I'm going like this when I ought to take my leave properly. What do you think, Sis? She asked when Sis made no reply. I don't know what to say. And so I've been thinking that since you've been with me this evening, they'll get to know that I went the rounds and that I did it as a way of thanking them. There's that, too. I've counted on your telling them about it, and I'd be grateful if you would, though I know that only a worthless creature would think things out like that. And now they would have to say goodbye. They were floating, almost at one with the darkness, reflecting no light. Their footsteps could not be heard, but their breathing could, and perhaps the heart. They mingled with other almost inaudible nocturnal stirrings, like a small vibration in long wires. Afraid of the dark? No. Bright woodwind players had appeared and were walking along the sides of the road.
Brilliant.
Bright woodwind players had appeared.
I know. But and this, it has to be said, this is the moment in the book, you think, previously at the beginning of the book when she's walking the streets, she is scared of the dark. She confesses she's scared of the dark, Sis. and she won't look at the sides of the roads because she hears voices, sinister voices from the sides of the roads. And somehow now, by this point in the narrative, they've become kind of woodwind, melodious woodwind. It's an astonishing trick
up the sleeve of a writer to do that. It reminded me, it did a weird mental trick to me this time, Carlo, which is that it reminded me of Giotto, who I've been thinking about for a project, which in turn reminded me of your book on angels, your second book into English, maybe your first. But I felt that there was this use, as you said, John, of repetition and mirroring, that you have this sense of her alone in the dark, and you suddenly have this sense of her with a potentially infinite number of consciousnesses, human and non-human, around her, which is terrifying and beautiful. It's an amazing piece.
Carlo, what is this like for you to hear English speakers discuss the rhythms, textures and themes of one of Norway's greatest writers? Does this overlap with how you would feel about it, or is the Venn diagram of the circle separate?
No, it's absolutely wonderful to hear, and that it is actually happening. I think every person I've met who actually have read him is a fan or really loves it. But there is something very nice about it, because if you grew up in Norway, you're used to him. You know, you can wear writers out. You know too much of them. But to discover him, I wish I could read him for the first time again. But still, I do take pleasure in reading him again and again, which I actually do.
And did the translation you just heard, did it feel right?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Great. Who is that? Who is the translator? We should give them credit where it's due.
Elizabeth Rockan for the Ice Palace.
Yeah, she's done a really good job.
Carlo, you talked about how he's articulating, you know, outsider figures or people who were not paid attention to.
Yeah.
Did he see himself in those terms?
Yeah, I think very much so.
Right.
He grew up in a farm. I think he was born 1898 or something. And he was expected to take over the farm. And it was no way he couldn't do it. But still, his urge to write was so strong that he actually pulled out and became a writer, which probably was the hardest thing he could be at that time. And then he felt bad about that throughout his life. So if you see interviews with him, he's talking about feeling guilt about doing nothing, just sitting looking. You have to defend it. It's really is a problem for him. And then you see that the places he goes are where nothing is produced. You know, it's one of the key conflicts in The Bird, is that he's not producing, he's not functioning at all. So I think he somehow felt probably felt like Mattis in The Bird somehow, I think. And he was also a very silent man, didn't speak almost at all. If you see an interview with him, it could take like 2 minutes before he replies and he will say yes. You know, it's like that kind of aura he has.
Let's get him on this podcast, he sounds like.
Well, he got me.
There is a recording of him where he compares himself. He said the character he most identifies with, I say this, I don't, I'm going at second hand, that he most identified with was Mattis, who is, as we say, has, you know, would be classed as having learning difficulties, but or on the autistic spectrum now, probably, but is, as Matt says, is also has that kind of, it is that sort of holy fool character, I guess, that he fulfills.
Max, he reminds me in some ways, not others, I'm going to say in some ways, not others, but he reminds me of a writer that you, Max Porter, you were the first person to recommend I read, which is Halldór Laxness from Iceland. Mm. There's a kind of... I mean, Laxness is more sort of elaborate and rococo in style.
And indeed
socialistic than Vasas. But nevertheless, there is a kind of sense in the biography of sort of the audacity of becoming a writer in that era in a relatively small country is something that these two authors have in common.
I think that's very true, and also the Finnish writer I mentioned before, Pasolini. Maybe it's a modernist preoccupation, you know, apocalyptic modernism, perhaps as well. You would find it perhaps in poetry in from the UK at that time, but they are all. I think it's funny what Karl Ove was saying about the sense of. This guilt about being a writer or so, but maybe it's also this sense of the world storm occurring elsewhere and you not responding adequately to it, not being earning enough money or being strong enough or looking after doing your duty.
Yes,
for the Icelandic sheep farmer is in a way the same as the 11-year-old girl in the playground, this sense of the expectation of others. And how that fractures not only yourself, but also ultimately your language and your ability to be a voice. So they have this deep, like, terror. In these books are still quiet, meditative things, but within them is this sort of roaring concern, worry. Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me there's a delightful, constant shying away from the obvious, you know? In another novel, Un would be more obviously bullied at school, or Sis would have a more difficult time with her family. But this is what I meant earlier when I said those rules don't apply here. You know, I find that scene near the beginning of the Ice Palace incredibly both meaningful and unknowable. Where the two girls meet in the room. I can't account for it. You know, there's something uncanny about it.
Du har vision, du.
Nej.
Då hör det gott.
That was the bit I was thinking of reading, the mirror scene, because you're talking about patterning, right? Eyes recur throughout the Ice Palace, including very memorably at the kind of the peak scene when Un is inside the Ice Palace. But this is the bit when they're looking at each other, simultaneously looking at each other in the mirror, sitting and looking into a mirror. Four eyes full of gleams and radiance beneath their lashes, filling the looking glass. Questions shooting out and then hiding again. I don't know. Gleams and radiance, gleaming from you to me, from me to you, and from me to you alone, into the mirror and out again. And never an answer about what this is. Never an explanation. Those pouting red lips of yours, no, they're mine. How alike. Hair done in the same way, and gleams and radiance. It's ourselves. We can do nothing about it. It's as if it comes from another world. The picture begins to waver, flows out to the edges, collects itself. No, it doesn't. It's a mouth smiling. A mouth from another world. No, it isn't a mouth. It isn't a smile. Nobody knows what it is. It's only eyelashes open wide above gleams and radiance. They let the mirror fall. Looked at each other with flushed faces, stunned. They shone towards each other, were one with each other. It was an incredible moment. It's...
Yeah.
Well, maybe, you know, Carlo, when in between you reading this before and you reading it now, what is your memory of that scene in the bedroom? What do you think of it? As a scene in a novel between two characters?
It is the central scene. It is what the start of the book leads up to. Because when Un is there at school, it's Sis is leading, she's a leader, she's the one who takes care of the others, and Un is just outside. And she refuses to go in there. And if she had got in there, she would have been also under that, in that play, and she refuses to play. And when they want to meet, she doesn't want to go to Sis. She wanted to take her home. She has something. There is some sort of equality that has to be built up between them, but it's very ambivalent too, and it's incredibly how he managed to describe those kind of that relation between them without mentioning it or without, you know, naming it. And there is so much tension between them, and you don't know what the tension is, but it is incredibly well done. And then this merge of those two in one, and then the split up, and then she lives with her in the months after, and it's like it's and you know, I don't know what it is or where it takes me, but it's just that scene is for me the kind of the center of the book, as important as the Ice Palace in itself.
The way that scene echoes into the Ice Palace even after the last reading of the thing, because when I reread it this time, which would be my fourth read of the book, I thought, well, this time I'll understand something in that scene that makes explicable what follows. I'll glean something between them, be it maybe it's an erotic thing, maybe it's something to do with the game they play, maybe there's more there that I miss. And obviously the fact that of it not being there is what is so precisely brilliant about his evocation of childhood games and childhood language. It makes me feel horribly lonely and excited in the way I remember feeling as a child. Pre-linguistic, there's no vocabulary for it.
Exactly.
Which is a hell of a trick.
Gleams and radiance. It's light, isn't it? The light in this book is just, you know, the light of, as you say, like the light of the palace, and then the light of the thaw when it comes.
And when someone's attention falls upon you.
Yeah.
And you crave it as a child, and then you realize that it may be freighted with all sorts of terrible dangers as well. And it's like a nausea. It's a wobbly feeling in your belly. It is to achieve that without actually saying anything is magnificent.
And then afterwards, when Un disappears, they desperately want to know, what did she tell you? Because she told her something. What was that? What did she tell you? And that's kind of a demand from the outer world. And of course she can't, but she knows it. And that's very much what Versus is about. There's no way to tell it, but you know it. And it's the same in the birds. It's the same conflict. He knows something, but he can't tell it. And you as a reader, you know it. It's that conflict with the inner and the outer. And he's so incredibly good in capturing the inner without naming it or without anything. It's just floating around there. But you somehow get it, but I can't tell you what she meant to say either.
I mean, it's ironic that the character that in the two books that spends most time thinking in some ways and trying to have theories is Mattis, who is, you know, the one who is supposedly whose brain is not functioning normally. I mean, I love his "Why are things the way they are?" is his big insight is still that is the basis of all philosophy. All theorizing about the universe and everything. Amazing. I've never read a writer who is as less corny than Versus. You know, everything feels there's a rightness to it. Even when you're groping for the understanding of it, as you are in that scene with them sitting on the bed, it's so subtle.
Carl Ove, but help us. There's a contextual thing I'd like to know. Obviously, we said earlier in the episode, you rate the birds very highly.
Mm.
We don't get to read all of his works in English because they haven't all been translated into English, right? Is he one of those writers with one or two great books and then a following train of reasonably good books? Or is he, in fact, incredibly consistent and there are many more delights
to be
that we have yet to discover?
There are many more delights, but he started out as a kind of very traditional, very realistic writer with a kind of romantic touch, but it's very different, and then he very gradually developed from there. And then he was a lot in Europe. He loved absurd theater and kind of was very much influenced by modernism, and wrote and Kafka, of course. is also very important to him, and wrote his novel started to be more allegorically, but in the same kind of setting. And then it's the birds, and then it's the Ice Palace, which is highlights. But all of those books, his later period, are somehow in one way or another great, but very different. Could be much more political or much more oriented to the World War. And in these two books and in his poetry, he kind of finds this balance between his first period and modernism, and blends it into his own. Almost, it's hard to see. I find it hard to read other influences in his writing. He's very much his own writer, I think. And he found that in those two books, I think. But also, yeah, some others as well. But these are his masterpieces. But it's great pleasure to read his early work too. It's good, but it's not it's not that level, I think.
Yeah, okay, interesting.
Can I ask a sort of personal writer to writer question? Do you warm to him as a person, as someone, as a Norwegian writer who has had huge international acclaim? Do you sympathize with him? Is there a slightly you know, in the kind of vertical axis, sometimes there is warmth, sometimes there is chilliness. Is there a warmth between you as writers in your mind,
between me and him? If there is a warmth for me towards him,
and the kind of kind of person he was, the way he dealt with success, the way he stayed to himself, etc.
Yeah, very much so. He managed to protect his writing, and he was you know, in his late life, people came in the 60s, the generation of writers in the 60s that would be like beat poets, or they admired him, started to admire him, and kind of rediscovered him almost, and they came, and he, I guess you would say, chilled out.
he was chilled out.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Andy, should we play that clip of his daughter talking about him, about writing?
Yeah, please.
And it's quite short, and it would be lovely to hear a bit of Norwegian.
Og skrev nok best, aller best, før noen andre var oppe, sa han. Og det jo også et minne som jeg har fra.
It was especially in the morning that he wrote. He was an early bird. He worked best before anyone else had got up in the morning. And that's one of the memories I have from many mornings. Because me and my brother's bedroom lay on the inside of his writing room. So sometimes when I woke up very early, I could hear the hum of the oven in his room. When it was very cold, the oven made a humming sound, and he sat and mumbled when he wrote. And that was the best sound I could wake up to. We often fell asleep to the sound of him writing on the machine. With two fingers.
Med to finger. Tap, tap, tap. Det var en trygg låt.
Tap, tap, tap. We got that bit.
I got
two
that
fingers.
Yeah.
I love that.
I can imagine many children to writers who doesn't have that experience with their fathers.
Let's get Max's children in right now.
Oh, God. The sounds of him cussing.
Tap, scratch, the scratch, scratch.
Click
the
of
window.
His lighter. Yeah,
there's a sense I have about him, a slightly Beckett sense about him. You know, that kind of very private, very but very precise about his work. You know, knows what he wants to do, but none of the sort of ego or the flouncing. Just
I think that's true. The ego thing is I think that's true.
And it's there in the writing too, as well. He's the opposite of a show off.
Exactly.
I think also maybe Beckett is a lovely comparison as well, because there is the work is dealt with in the most utmost seriousness, but there is always a twinkle, and it's the twinkle that I think is so humane in this work, that little bit of humor or wit, even when terrible things happen. I mean, at the end of The Birds, it's done with tremendous lightness of touch. Funny, fussy little details that warm it to us. Yeah, it's not so much taking yourself seriously, it's taking the work so seriously that almost in a sort of sacred sphere that you are still allowed to make jokes in the pulpit.
And we're gonna have to wrap up in a minute, but I'm very keen Karlove, that we hear some of Vasas's prose in the Norwegian, so we can hear the musicality of it. No pressure, but we would love to. We would love to hear that, please,
from either book. Yeah,
yeah. So, how much do you want me to read? I can read from the opening of just a tiny bit of the opening of the Ice Palace, maybe.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. The first couple of paragraphs of the Ice Palace, that would be wonderful.
En ung kvit panne som borer seg fram gjennom mørket. En 11 års jente, Sis. I grunnen var det bare ettermiddag, men alt mørkt. Harfrossen seinhaust. Stjerne, men ingen måne. Og ingen snø til å lage lysskjema, så mørket var tett, trass i stjernene. På sidene var det dødsstill skog. Med alt som måtte leve og fryse der inne i denne stund. Sis hadde mange tanker der hun gikk, innballet for frosten, og skulle bort til den halvt ukjente jenta Unn for første gang, til noe hun ikke visste, derfor ble dette spennende. Hun for sammen, et høyt brak midt i disse tankene, denne ventinga, et langt brestende, liksom, bortover og bortover, medan det dovna av. Det var fra isen på det store vannet her nedenfor. Og det var ingen fare, var i staden gledelig. Braket fortalte at isen ble enda et grann sterkere. Det dunde som børseskåt og sprang lange, knivsmale revner fra overflata og djupt ned igjennom. Likevel ble isen sterkere og sterkere til hver morgen. Det hadde vært en uvanlig lang og hard barfrosthaust. Gneistrende kulde. Men kulden var ikke sist noe redd. Det var ikke det, og stokk for braket i mørkret. Men så setter foten støtt i vegen att.
God, that was bloody wonderful. You should see, listeners, you can't see this, but the smiles on the faces of me, Max Porter and John Mitchison while Karlove was reading that. Thank you so much. That was just, it's wonderful. We get to hear the rhythms of
it. It's beautiful.
And the feel of it. It's beautiful. Thank you so much. So
I'm afraid, sadly, that's where we must leave Unn and Sis and Mattis and Heger behind. Huge thanks to Max and Karlove for the invitation to explore the strange and beautiful world of Vasas's fiction. To Luke for making us all sound like we're on the same winter walk, and to Unbound for the double mittens.
You can download all 174 previous episodes, plus follow links, clips and suggestions for further reading by visiting our website at ballisted.fm. And we're always pleased if you contact us on Twitter and Facebook, and now in Sound and Pictures on Instagram too.
You can also show your love directly by supporting our Patreon at www.patreon.com/backlisted. What do you get for your money? Well, all patrons get to hear backlisted episodes early and advertising free. And for even less than Mattis's pay for thinning out two rows of turnips, who subscribe to the Locklisten 11 get two extra podcasts every month. It's called Locklisted. Think of it as our very own ice palace, where we three wrap up warm and slip from icy room to icy room, enticing one another ever deeper into the mystery with stories taken from the books, films and music we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.
Locklisters also get to hear their names read out on the show as a mark of our thanks and appreciation. This week's new patrons include
Elizabeth Growlton, Alison Rowe, and Sarah Imholt. Thank you.
Yes, thanks so much. Thank you all for your generosity, and to all our patrons, huge thanks for enabling us to continue to do what we love and enjoy. Thank you so much to our guests, Karlove Knausgård and Max Porter. Let me come to you, Max, first. This is a new tradition we've instituted since the last time you were on this podcast. Is there anything you feel we haven't covered, or anything you would like to say, or anything you would like to tell the listeners about the work of Tarjei Vasas?
Well, we didn't really talk about what happened in the book, and I'm delighted because I think it's something that people must discover for themselves. But as an English reader, I have in my life benefited so utterly, so totally and transformatively from the work of translators and publishers that take risks on translated fiction. So in America, these books are published by Archipelago Books. In this country, they're published by Peter Owen, and now by Penguin Classics, as you say, and translated. You know, we've mainly been reading the translations of Elizabeth Rockan, which strike me as pitch perfect And just immense gratitude. And these books were smuggled to me, you know, by like secrets in the bookshop. And I would encourage people to do the same. They're not noisy, spectacular, attention-grabbing books. They're books that live in you and grow and deserve to be reread. So I would just encourage people to go out and support these independent presses and these translators that do this work. It's a miracle.
A miracle. How perfect. Mm. Yes. How true. Thank you. Kalove, is there anything you would like to share with the English-speaking world about the work of Taye Versos that we haven't been able to cover today, that you feel we should know about his work?
Yeah, well, it's when you read those books, or when I read those books, it's like I'm completely filled up. They are so rich and there's so much going on. And when I want to talk about it, I can't say anything. It's like it's all in the reading experience. And that's also kind of what these books are about, you know. It's about the inner world and being not able to communicate it. And he's the one, I think, that is kind of capturing that in such an amazing way. I really love his work. And but I can't say anything about it, unfortunately. So maybe I shouldn't have come to the show.
Admittedly, this is, the love of a book that cannot be articulated. That's why we're here, listeners. And yet, I guarantee you people will go from here and want to read these books.
Yeah.
I found this a really, both the experience of reading the books and listening to you both talk about them has been revelatory to me. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing them with us.
Absolutely.
John, anything you would like to add to that encomium?
Yeah, I mean, I'm minded of our guest and friend, David Keenan, who has that phrase, holy books. These two books seem to me to be, in as much as I can understand the concept of what is holy, that they've definitely entered the pantheon for me. These are books I'll be reading and learning from for the rest of my life. So thank you both for the opportunity to do that.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, okay, Kalove. Thanks very much, everybody. Thanks, Max. Thanks, Kalove. Thanks, Jill Mitchison. Thanks, producer Luke. Thanks, Nikki Birch. Thanks very much. Thanks, guys. See you next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Guys, that was brilliant.